Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jamie. Host Latara Smith talks with family members of James Bell and Michael Scott, who have been denied medical parole by the Missouri Department of Corrections, even though they have only 3 to 6 months to live because of their medical conditions. Then, host Melvin Merritt talks to Will Averill of Willow Domestic Violence Center about National Domestic Violence Awareness Month and an upcoming public event to raise awareness to help empower survivors, male and female, to rebuild and regrow after domestic violence. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal from Prison Radio at the end of our broadcast. We want to thank our engineer, Keith Washburn. Now to Latara and her guests.
Well, hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm your host, Latara Smith of the KC Freedom Project. And today we are here to discuss a very important topic that many people probably don't think about, a topic that is ignored quite a bit. And that specific topic is the Missouri Department of Corrections and their process for what we call medical parole or a compassionate release. This morning, I am blessed with the opportunity to interview two family members of some individuals who are currently incarcerated at the Crossroads Correctional Facility. Both of these individuals have been deemed and diagnosed by their primary care physician to be terminally ill and given anywhere from 3 to 6 months to live. This is the reason, you guys, that this topic is so important, and it has to be addressed and addressed immediately. So before I go any further, I have Mrs. Destrina Smith. Thank you for coming in and sitting here and speaking with me today, ma'am.
You're welcome.
Okay, you might want to come up a little closer. Thank you so much for coming in today. And then we have Mrs. Helen Spencer on the line. Ms. Spencer, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, thank you. I want to thank you, too, for participating.
You're welcome.
Let's start with Mrs. Smith. Mrs. Smith, you have a brother who is currently incarcerated at Crossroads Correctional Facility. What's your brother's name?
My brother's name is Michael Scott.
Michael Scott. Okay. And how long has your brother been incarcerated at Crossroads?
About 7 to 8 years.
7 to 8 years. So has that been his entire time that he's been confined within the Missouri Department of Corrections?
Yes.
Okay. All righty. And your brother, tell us a little bit about your brother's medical situation. What's going on with him right now?
He has throat cancer.
Okay.
He was diagnosed maybe 5 months ago.
Okay.
And they gave him 3 months to live.
They gave him 3 months to live. And how long ago did they do that?
It's been about 3.5, 4 months now.
About 3.5 or 4 months now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so your brother, most definitely, if he was diagnosed with a terminal illness, okay, mm-hmm. and was given 6 months or less to live, you know, according to DOC policy, he meets the criteria to be approved for a medical parole, or what is also known as a compassionate release. Mrs. Spencer, tell me a little bit about your brother. What's your brother's name?
James Bell.
And how long has your brother been incarcerated within the Missouri Department of Corrections?
5 years.
5 years. Okay. And he, too, is at Crossroads Correctional Facility, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about your brother's medical situation and what's going on, and, you know, if you guys have asked for a medical parole, or, you know, what's the whole deal? What's going on?
Well, we're trying to work on that. He had been complaining for about a year and a half of his side and stomach hurting, and they kept telling him, you know, that he had gas and they would give him aspirin or Motrin, something like that, until it got so bad so he started urinating blood. So that's when they finally seek medical help for him.
Okay. And then at that point, that's when they diagnosed him with cancer?
Well, not at first. After he complained again, they sent him back, and he insisted on an ultrasound himself. And that's when they found the cyst on his kidney.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Okay, so he has since then been diagnosed with cancer. Is that correct?
Yes, pancreatic cancer that spread to his liver.
Okay, and with him being diagnosed with this illness, your brother was given a certain amount of time to live, correct?
Right, 3 to 6 months.
3 to 6 months, okay. Now, I want to bring, you know, this really disturbs me as well as it saddens my heart, because according to the Missouri DOC policy, okay, the eligibility for someone to make a medical parole, okay, there's a few factors here, okay. One factor is the offender has to be afflicted with a disease that is terminal, okay, and their death is anticipated within 6 months, okay. An offender is either it's either that or an offender is in need of long-term nursing care. Okay, and it would be better off for that individual to be like in a nursing home or receiving some type of long-term nursing care as opposed to the care that they would be able to receive within the prison there. Now, we all know that, you know, there's a lot of complaints with the medical at Crossroads Correctional Facility. We've heard about it. We're familiar with it. And we know that, too, is something that can't be ignored. And there's a lot of reports of men at Crossroads who are now diagnosed with either throat, pancreatitis, or you know, the stomach cancer. And it just makes you wonder what's the common denominator for all these men at Crossroads to be diagnosed with the same thing? Is it the food they're serving? Is it the water? What is it? But there are a lot of men that have contacted me to say, Ms. Smith, I've been now diagnosed with cancer. They're not giving me the proper medical treatment. Now, let me go back to the topic of the fact of these medical paroles. Now, which one of you did your brother, Mrs. Destrina, did your brother apply for medical parole?
Yes, he applied for it, but he was denied.
Okay, and your brother was denied medical parole even though he was terminally ill, diagnosed with his terminal illness by the primary care physician there at the prison, and given how many months to live?
He was given 3 months to live.
3 months to live, and he was denied.
Yes.
Okay. Now, I've researched your brother's case as well as your brother's criminal history. Now, there are some things, there are some factors that would cause a person not to be able to meet the criteria to be released on medical parole, even if they were diagnosed with a terminal illness and given less than 6 months to live. There are a few things, but as I research your brother's case, your brother doesn't fall in that category. And that would be, I'm going to read it straight off their website, non-parolable parole restricted offenses. The board will not consider medical parole for offenders serving a sentence of death, which that's not either one of your brother's situations, offenders serving a sentence for a crime that is not parolable, that's not neither of your brother's situation, and then offenders serving a sentence that has a minimum prison term that has not been satisfied. And according to research that I've done, that does not apply to either of your brothers. Mm-hmm. So why your brother was denied medical parole, we need to get the question. We need to ask that question to the powers that be, and we need to get the answers. What was the reason that they gave you guys that your brother was denied medical parole, Mrs. Smith?
They said to me that he wasn't sick enough, meaning that he should be in hospice.
Okay. Who told you he was not sick enough?
The director of medical and also the assistant warden.
The assistant warden at Crossroads.
Yes.
Okay. Can you recall the assistant warden's name?
I can't.
Okay. Because according to DOC's website, the process for one to apply for a medical parole, or how it goes, is all requests for medical parole will be forwarded to the institution's primary care physician. The primary care physician will submit a recommendation to the parole board when the offender meets the medical parole criteria. And according to what you've told me, and according to speaking with your brother, he most definitely met the medical parole criteria. So why? The question is, why was he denied? And that was something else. Now, Mrs. Spencer, I understand that you emailed over to find out who your brother's primary care physician was. You emailed over to the DOC constituents office, correct?
Not me, my sister.
Your sister did. Okay. And what type of response did your sister get?
You know, she didn't discuss it with me, so I really don't know about that. But she did tell me that the doctor, after my brother had a conversation with the doctor and told them, you know, that how he felt about them taking so long to do this, and how a lot of other inmates have died for them taking so long for them to get help, as that, you know, and the doctor said, well, I guess we need to file for a medical discharge for you.
Okay. Meaning a medical parole, but no one has done anything about it yet.
Either, that's what the doctor said yesterday.
Okay. You mean on Friday, because yesterday was Sunday. Okay. Okay. Well, I'm really...
No, he called. He called.
Oh, your brother called
night.
You
that's
yesterday.
What I'm talking about.
Oh, okay.
That's what he told my sister yesterday.
Okay. I spoke to you and your sister, so it's a little bit confusing. Okay. Because when I emailed over to the constituent's office, and I did that for you, Mrs. Smith, on behalf of your brother, because, you know, you want to, you know, it says that the primary care physician is the one who is going to initiate this process. So, you know, if we're going to call the primary care physician, we need to know who the primary care physician is. Correct. Mm-hmm. Well, I emailed over to DLC constituents office and I get this runaround email that says, you know, contact the prison for that information. And I respond back because I gave a two-party question and said, okay, there's a necessary medical form that you guys advise you guys to get that medical form. It's a medical release form that you guys need to get to have your brother sign so that you can access your brother's medical records. Because if not, no one would be able to get those medical records, if I'm not mistaken, without a subpoena. So I had told him, you know, you guys get the form. So I emailed over a two-part question. Number one, I emailed over, is there a particular form that DOC uses so that I can provide it for the family members who want to get control over the, you know, who want to get access their loved one's medical records? And the second question was, who is the primary care physician? Well, of course, the first email, they respond back, give me a vague runaround answer, didn't address neither one of my questions. And the second email, when I specifically said, okay, can you please tell me who the primary care physician is for Crossroads Correctional Facility? They told me to call the facility. Okay. That's what they told me to do. And from what I understand, Mrs. Spencer, they told your sister the same thing as a result of her emailing them to call the facility. Now we call the facility and now we have a game of, you know, ring around the rosies. We can't mm-hmm. get anybody, you know, they have caller ID. They see when we're calling. So they, I'm assuming, are ignoring our calls because we can't get anyone to pick up. And if we do get someone to pick up, we're put on hold and then we're disconnected. Okay. So, you know, this is something here that we really need to bring. I really need you people in the community to know what is going on with these situations. You know, if we have individuals who meet the criteria to be released on medical parole, okay, then they should be given that opportunity. If policy states that they have to, you know, if they meet the criteria that policy, protocol, and procedure specifically states, then why are these men and women not being paroled? It's a question. You want to say something, ma'am? Go ahead.
I'm really confused of why he's not paroled when there's nothing that he can do there, not meet any of his medical needs. Like, I visited him yesterday, and he was in so much pain to where I had to end the visit, but at the same time, they wasn't giving him medicine.
Mm-hmm.
He said that they told him he has to wait until Tuesday when the doctor does come in so they'll know what medicine to provide him, because the medicine that he was taking, they stopped giving it, saying that they don't have any more of that medicine.
Right. And, you know, I think it's horrible that they play around and they take their time in a situation like this. Your brother was given a certain amount of time to live. So every day counts. And if the primary care physician, if they're the ones that initiate this, in my opinion, and I worked in the medical field for 27, 28 years, okay? Mm-hmm. My opinion as someone, as a previous medical professional person, my medical opinion would be, if my client was, or my patient was diagnosed with something like that, mm-hmm. and I know that the policy says he can get out of here, and I know that this individual only has so many months to live,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to diligently work that case, process that, and whatever I need to do, I'm going to do that so that I can get this individual, you know, out to where they can receive better care or out to be with their family these last months. Mm-hmm. And I just don't understand why they would know someone has been terminally ill and diagnosed within months, and then they tippy tap toe skip top top around without processing this medical parole on an expedited basis. Mm-hmm. It absolutely makes it makes no sense. Let me just finish reading their policy, because we want to make sure. See, that's what you do. You hold people accountable to their policy. Mm-hmm. So let me just start over. It says, our request for medical parole will be forwarded to the institution's primary care physician. The primary care physician will submit a recommendation to the parole board when the offender meets the medical parole criteria. The board will then review the case without a personal hearing, make a decision, and forward the decision in writing to the offender. Okay. It's right there in black and white. So I don't understand why they are not adhering to their own policy. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't understand. So Mrs. Spencer, when was the last time you said you spoke with your brother yesterday? Is that correct?
And each time that I talk to him, he sounds weaker and weaker. He was in a lot of pain last night, and he says they're really not, you know, giving him that much for the pain. He's in constant pain. It eases up, but it never completely goes away.
Okay. And so we're going to have to really make some phone calls today and really address this. And so he, too, is having issues of not receiving. Is he saying that he's not receiving proper medical treatment?
Yes. And then when he did finally get to see the doctor, he said he had to fill out some type of paperwork, and then it took 2 months for him to even get to see the doctor. And then after the nurse saw him, he had to fill out more paperwork, and then it took about 3 months before he was able to see the doctor. And the doctor told him, you know, there's nothing wrong with you. You know, you probably have gas. You know, we're going to give you something for gas and give you a couple of Motrin. And this went on for months until he, like I said, he finally started urinating blood and was bent over so bad he couldn't, you know, stand up straight.
Okay. But from the time, let's talk about not ignoring his past medical issues or history, but let's talk about from the time he was diagnosed. Has he been able to access the doctor, the nurses, easier, or is it still a long wait before he can get to them, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or whatever the case may be? Has he stated?
No, he didn't say. From my understanding, I think he's in like the where they keep the inmates that are sick.
Yes.
So he's there. So I'm assuming he's getting some type of medical attention.
Okay. All righty. And Ms. Smith, what about Mr. Scott? What does Mr. Scott tell you?
He does not get the medical attention that he needs.
Is he in the hospital infirmary like
her
brother?
Yes, he's in the infirmary. He's been there the last 4 or 5 months. And just even yesterday, he showed me where he has a feeding tube. And the feeding tube has an infection in it. And he can't even get them to clean it for him. He showed it to me, and I was like, well, I'm going to call down there today, see if I can talk to someone. But, no, he's not getting the medical attention. He's been waiting. I know it's been 2 weeks now for the director of medical to come and talk to him so he can tell her some of the issues that's going on with him.
Right.
But she will not come down and talk to him.
Well, and, you know, when I called over, you know, not only would they release the name of the primary care physician, but they also wouldn't give me the name of the medical director. You know, so my question was, is there a medical director for each facility? You know, what is, I mean, I can easily find that out, but I was just on the phone with him, so I just posed that question. Mm-hmm. And they absolutely just, you know, they're going to shut me down. They're not going to answer any questions. You know, the phone hangs up, then you call back and you can't get an answer.
Right.
Okay. And they can clearly see who's calling. They have caller ID. And so that could be why I think your sister, Mrs. Spencer, said she kept continuing to call back when her call was disconnected, I believe, or they told her to call back. Someone was not in. That's what it was. They told her to call back. Someone was not in who she needed to speak to. And then when she did call back, she could never get them to answer.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and I highly suggest for you ladies too, if you don't know who your state rep is, find out who your state rep is and talk to your state representative and make your state representative aware you know, of your brother's situations, okay, so that they can step in and so that they can help and be involved with this situation. Because this is really serious, you know, medical parole, if they meet the criteria, there is no justifiable reason why they are not paroling these men. And you know what? I found out about your two brothers' situations just last week. And I immediately got on it once I found out about it, because I understand time is of the essence here.
Right.
So, you know, I found out just about your two brothers here last week. But how many more? This is the question. How many more men and women are in this same situation within the Missouri Department of Corrections, mm-hmm. who maybe don't have family members to reach out to, advocates, or don't have anyone to speak up for them? And they're receiving this same type of treatment, mm-hmm. you know, this same type yeah. of treatment. It's also kind of like a situation in ADSEG where we have a lot of reports of people being misused and abused in ADSEG. And some of these people don't have family members that can reach out and contact people on the outside and make people aware of what's going on with their loved one on the inside. And many times those type of people fall through the cracks because they don't have that support system on the outside to make calls. So, you know, I really want to thank you two ladies. Ms. Spencer, I know your other sister is not on with us today, but I thank all of you guys for being a support system for your loved one who is incarcerated, for making those phone calls, for sending those emails, for speaking out and being a voice for your incarcerated loved one, because it is very, very important for you to do. And it does make a difference. So, mm-hmm. thank you, yeah. ladies, for doing that. Well, we're coming close to an end. Ms. Spencer, is there anything that you want to say to the people before we get finished with the show here?
Yes, I just think that, like you said, you know, they need to do some investigating, because I believe there is more than those two that's in there with those same complaints and conditions that's dying right now and not getting medical help, and possibly could be saved if they got to in time.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I totally agree with you. And what about you, Ms. Smith? What would you like to say in closing?
I agree with Ms. Spencer that the loved ones of the prisoners need to be the advocate for the prisoners, because if they have someone on the outside that can help them, they will be able to get the help a little better, because on the inside, they're not getting any type of help at all. I know my brother's been telling me all kind of stories of people that he's only been in there 4 to 5 months in the infirmary, and he's telling me about so many people that's coming in there passing away. Nobody's coming to check on them, so the doctors and the nurses are just throwing them any kind of way.
Right, right.
And even with me, they're helping my brother. My brother's going through a lot of things also.
Yes, yes.
And I'm there.
And you know how I found out about your brothers was another inmate contacted me, and we were talking about something different. And then, you know, that subject came up, and I was like, hey, wait a minute, tell them to call me. I will help them to get this medical parole process going. If they've been diagnosed, like, tell them, call me like today. I'll answer the phone Saturday, Sunday, whatever. Tell them to call me because I understand the importance of this. So, you know, people, this is real. This is another situation. This is something else that is going on with the Missouri Department of Corrections that most definitely needs to be addressed. And it's not just going on with the Missouri Department of Corrections, but it's going on right there at the Crossroads Correctional Facility. And as we all know, there's a lot of issues with CRCC and everything that's been going on over there. So I want to thank everyone for tuning in today. You guys, please, you know, Be wake and see what's going on in our community, because it's happening right here under our noses. Everyone, thank you for tuning in, and you all have a very, very blessed day.
You too. Thank
now
you.
The calendar for the week of October 8th. Crossroads Correctional Center Family and Friends Advocacy Group will hold their monthly meeting Saturday the 13th, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Southeast Branch Library. There will be updates on conditions at CRCC and a lawsuit against the Department of Corrections. Due to illness, last week's meeting was postponed. Monthly meetings will resume on the first Saturday of the month, starting in November. Mothers of incarcerated sons and daughters will have their monthly meetings Saturday, October 13th, from noon to 2 p.m. at the Waldo Branch Library, 201 East 75th Street, KCMO. If you have a loved one that is incarcerated and need advice and support, MISD has members that may be able to help. Survivors Unite is uniting families who have lost a loved one to violent crime. They understand that grief is experienced in different stages and help families heal and learn to properly release their emotions. Survivors United meets every third Monday of the month and will meet Monday, October 15th, 7 p.m. at Margaret's Place, 7217 Troost, KCMO. The Kansas City Chapter of Missouri Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Errants, Missouri Cure, will have their monthly meeting Monday, October 15th, 6:30 p.m. at the Chestnut Avenue Family Resource Center, 3811 Chestnut Avenue, KCMO. They will be discussing the results of their recent conference and future activities. My name is Jamie, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. Up next is Melvin Merritt and his guest.
Good morning, Kansas City. This is the Jaws of Justice right here on KKFI 90.1 FM. On your dial, I'm your host, Melvin Merritt, and I did have in the studio, but now we have him on the phone, so I'm excited about that. He couldn't make it, so we're going to be talking about this morning with, at least talking with Mr. Will Averill, and he is the Director of Community Engagement. He's also over the Willow Domestic Violence Center. So I'm really excited about having him as my guest this morning because I know the topic is going to be interesting, especially as it relates to domestic violence towards men. And so at this time, I'm a welcome Mr. Avery, and I'd like to say Will so we can start off, and I'm a little more comfortable with the word Will. Good morning.
Good morning. That's a great introduction. I appreciate it. And yeah, Will's fine. Mr. Averill always makes me feel weird. I want to refer people to my dad, you know. So Will's great.
All right. Will, one of the things I looked at is also the statistics, and I didn't really want to get in it, but I thought it was interesting to find out that 1 in 7 men are victims of domestic violence. Could you kind of enlighten us on that, opposed to the 1 in 3 women are victims of domestic violence?
Absolutely. The statistics, 1 in 7, is from the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and it is actually the statistic we used initially when we were going through the process of kind of talking to the community about the reasons that we need to serve underserved communities such as male survivors. The number is actually that the Domestic Violence Center, the national organization, is now using is actually a far more frightening number, and that is 1 in 4 men will experience domestic violence or will experience interpersonal violence, which means violence from a known person in their lives, in their lifetime. So 1 in 7 was the statistic that we had kind of been using up until recently, but that has kind of shifted down to 1 in 4. And I believe that number still to be underreported. There are many reasons that men choose not to report instances of domestic violence, and so I think that leaves the number lower than it actually should be. So,
what I was thinking about, because I'm from the old school, that when a man is violently abused by a woman, that he's possibly henpecked. What do you think about that?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the last part of that.
That he's henpecked.
I think that has been kind of traditionally the reason that men have been hesitant to report. Mm-hmm. Abuse. A lot of times it's seen as there's this perceived notion that In the relationship, the man should inherently have control, and therefore to lose control is is something to be ashamed of. But when we are looking at the cycle of abuse, and when we're looking at systemic abuse and how abuse comes from a place of power and control, and that is something done by one person to impose their will on that person and maintain their will on that person no matter what that person wants or tries to do, then it becomes kind of less of a situation of that person has control of their own circumstances. It's important to remember that most of these abusive situations don't just happen in the first sort of on the first date or in the first instance or even in the first few years of the relationship. When we're talking about a long-term pattern of abuse, we're talking about something that is cultivated and groomed by an abuser, no matter what their gender or gender identity, over their victim for a number of years. So it's more than just I think that has been the perception, but I think one of the things we're trying to do is change that model and say, well, we need to look at the overall picture of the scope of this relationship. We need to look not just at physical violence, which is devastating both for people's health and financially and for our community in general, but we also need to look at individual instances, and we also need to look at what's happening in this relationship overall. So that's kind of what we're approaching it as, and that's one of the myths that we're working to kind of break down.
As I was looking into this, from my understanding, the women organization has been set up to protect women as it relates to men abusing women, that they think that because if men or the light is shown on men's abusiveness as it relates to a woman abusing them, that they don't want that to happen because it would take the focus off of what they're trying to do. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think that is... And that is an argument that is kind of beyond a little bit beyond the scope of where we're at. I can understand how that people are looking at kind of their situation and what they need for their circumstances. But where we're coming from is that we want to remove the gendered influence from people's ability to report. It has traditionally been a big barrier for men to report. So we want to try to break down those barriers. The perceptions, we do try to gradually change through outreach and through community presentations and through trainings. And yes, these programs, many of them around the country, did come from a long line of feminism and an idea of women needing to take care of each other because no one else would. But more and more what we're seeing as we move forward is that there are so many systemic influences that are keeping populations from getting the help they need to break the cycle of violence, that rather than staying in those strict constraints of just one gender helping their gender or one type of person helping another type of person, we can be an institution that seeks to break down the cycle of violence throughout our community, regardless of gender identity, background, race, religion, any of that. So that's what we're attempting to do. And then we're attempting to kind of break down these myths of the phrase battered woman and battered woman syndrome came in the 70s and 80s when domestic violence was just being taken seriously, and we have been there, and now we've kind of moved beyond that to look at systemic abuse on all levels for all people, and how we can break down that cycle.
I almost have two questions for you.
Sure.
One is that do they have any organizations where men can come and talk about these different issues? And the other one is the IPV. Where men are in a relationship, but they're not married, but yet they are being abused by the woman. What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that you don't have to understand. Each organization has its own set of rules and its own set of services. We are one of the few shelter support centers in Kansas that offers these services to male survivors. Not all of them do. It's basically it comes down to the needs of the organization and the needs of the community in terms of what they're comfortable with. So it is still, I think, an ongoing process and an ongoing development. But what services we provide are all of our emergency shelter services. We also provide access to community outreach. We've had male survivors in domestic violence support groups, and we've had male survivors in our sort of financial literacy and healthy parenting courses. So we have kind of taken the idea that we'll just open up everything and go forward with that and concentrate on breaking down as many of those barriers for men to receive help as we can. And so far, it's been very, very effective for us.
Sure.
And the second part of the question, I think I lost it in the first part of the question. So what was the second part?
Well, one of the things I was asking is that, first of all, was, and I think you answered that, and did they, you know, do any of these organizations have groups where men can come? And also, I asked about the IPV.
Yes. Yeah, it's very interesting because it is one of the biggest barriers we face. And IPV doesn't necessarily have to be a partner. It can be a parent or a grandparent or a child. I think it all comes back to that what we talked about a little earlier, is that myth of a man should be in control of his situation, right. And to admit any sort of loss of control is to admit some lack of manhood, whatever that may be.
Right.
But what we're trying to, you know, replace that mythology with is that, you know, we are all people, we are all part of a community.
Sure.
There's systems that are in place. Not all of them that we had any. I mean, a lot of them we have nothing to do with. They're just sort of what we're placed into, and some of those systems are healthy and some of those systems are unhealthy. What we want to look at is...
Explain. I hate cutting you off, but explain.
Oh,
what is the unhealthy part that you mentioned?
Well, for example, you know, if someone has grown up in a household where there was a cycle of violence and abuse, it's very easy for that cycle to continue on to the next generation. Now, that doesn't mean that people are not accountable for their actions. Mm-hmm. We believe very much in taking accountability and empowering people to make change rather than treating people ever as a victim in a circumstance. You know, we want them to have the power and control that they can over their own decisions. But there are situations in which it is much more prone to repeat itself, and that cycle of violence going on from generation is a situation that is a factor, you know, in the same way that the drugs and alcohol don't cause domestic violence, they can exacerbate it.
Sure.
Poverty doesn't cause systematic violence, it can exacerbate it. Systemic racism and systemic inequality don't cause domestic violence, but they can exacerbate it.
Sure. I'm hearing maybe one of our listeners saying, because we use the acronym, what is IPV?
Interpersonal violence. It's basically any when you say domestic violence, that's violence between partners in a relationship. IPV opens up that definition to include people who may not be in a romantic relationship, but maybe in a domestic relationship, parents, grandparents, children, roommates, that sort of thing. So IPV is kind of a broader scope of the domestic scenario.
So back to my question, are there any organizations that open up their doors for men that can come in and talk about some of these issues and work through them and to find out exactly what they can do about their situation? And that way it gives them some anonymity about what's happening in their own life as it relates to a relationship.
Absolutely. You know, we have several here in Douglas County and Franklin and Jefferson County, and I know that the programs in Kansas City do the same. The first thing I would recommend is, you know, get in touch by a phone. I mean, that can always be anonymous. That's a situation where most hotlines will not, you know, ask for specific details before offering help. They're more interested in offering help than they are in getting your personal information. So that's always a very, very good way to start. Many of those programs have outreach. For example, we hold what's called the Willow Branch at the Lawrence Public Library, which is open office hours at the public library on Thursday mornings.
Which we're available.
In our sort of Moody offices, anytime if somebody wants to come talk to us directly. So we try to maintain kind of an open door for people who want to come and get more information. But I would say the easiest and probably most confidential way to do that is to contact the hotline. For us, the hotline is 1-800-770-3030. So people can give that a call. We may not be able to offer emergency shelter services if they're outside of our service area, but we're happy to answer any questions and help get people referrals to a local organization that can help them.
What areas do you serve?
We serve Douglas, Franklin, and Jefferson County. So basically, you know, kind of Ottawa and Lawrence, Kansas, Baldwin, Eudora, DeSoto, that area. So that part of your listening area right there.
What about the Jackson County?
We do not serve Jackson County, but again, we'd be happy to refer people to services that do in that area. So,
is there very many agencies that address these issues in Jackson County?
Let me just check into that as we're talking, and I will find out for you. I'm not sure offhand. I mean, I know that the There are several in the Kansas City area, and I'm sure that some of them serve a wide variety of the surrounding counties. So you can either call us or you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline, and they can refer to a local shelter.
Yeah, just like we alluded to the fact that the 1 in 7 men are victims of this, so that is pretty large. And then all the ones that doesn't mention this, need to know that there is some help out there for the individuals that might be victims of this and needing to maybe to reach out to someone and ask them, what can we do or what can I do? Because I'm living in an abusive situation and maybe they don't know how to come out of it. Maybe economically that they have to stay in it. I don't know. But, you know, they need to know that there is an organization, not only in your area that you address, but also in the Jackson County area and the surrounding areas that might be listening to the sound of our voice. Give that number again in case somebody just tuned in. And let me remind listeners that just tuned in to us, you're listening to KKFI 90.1 FM on your dial. This is Jaws of Justice, and my name is Melvin Merritt, and my guest this morning is Mr. Will Abriel, and he is the director of the community engagement, and he's also over the Willow Domestic Violence Center. So as we were talking, Will, if you don't mind, some of the other things that you might want to address and let our audience know about your organization.
Sure. Well, just to give you our hotline number again is 800-770-3030. And a little bit about our program is the Willow Domestic Violence Center is the name of it. It serves Douglas, Franklin, and Jefferson counties in Kansas. We offer a 30-bed emergency shelter, which is in a confidential location in Lawrence, and where survivors of domestic violence or human trafficking of any gender or gender identity can stay for 30 days with up to 3 10-day extensions after that. During that time, we have a number of resources available to work with survivors to rebuild their lives, to move on to whatever situation that they are going to move on to, or if they are going to return to their homes or their current situation, to help safety plan to make sure that they're doing so in the safest way way possible. In addition to that, we offer presentations, trainings, and outreach. Court advocacy for many survivors getting a protection order is a necessity. We help survivors fill those out. We attend court dockets on domestic violence to stand with survivors who may be seeing their abusers for the first time since they left their abusive situations, which can be incredibly traumatic.
Sure.
So it's good to have, we have trained volunteers who go and stand with them and you know, help them get through that time, and also offer support for any services or referrals they may need. We can help to replace lost documentation. We occasionally help survivors get transitional housing or help with utilities or help with situations that come up and are barriers to them, you know, sort of reintegrating into the community without that abuser and on their own. So that's sort of a what we do. One question you'd asked earlier, Melvin, is there a local sort of service or service that serves Jackson County? There is one that I've got here. It's a new house, and their hotline number is 816-471-5800. I don't know what their status is on accepting survivors, if they accept women only or men, or if they're what their rules are on that. But that's a place that people can go that does serve locally. So if you're not in the Douglas, Franklin, or Jefferson County area, that might be a resource.
You know, most of us, we are aware of the young girls trafficking, and you somewhat alluded to that about trafficking. How does that relate to men?
Well, there are many situations, particularly amongst younger men and transgender folks, where they are there's a higher rate of people leaving home early and homelessness, and that then can become very quickly a situation in which traffickers take advantage. We have this perception of trafficking being either an international problem or a problem that only happens in big cities, but it is a situation that it does affect. It does happen everywhere. In fact, anywhere there's a major highway, there are oftentimes are rife with trafficking, just because traffickers will pick up someone in one location like Wichita and then move them to Kansas City, or pick them up in, you know, in Kansas City and move them down to Wichita, where they're kind of networks set up, loose networks of traffickers who will then take advantage of them for labor or sex or control.
You know, I don't want to too much jump off from what you're talking about, because I think it's interesting. But you mentioned about incorporating the victim back with the family. I was just wondering, how does that work when the family member is the perpetuator of that violence towards their mate or whatever the case may be? Do you bring that family into a clinical setting, or how do you do that?
Well, first and foremost, we are an agency that serves survivors, and I just want to kind of clear up a little bit of my linguistics. We use the term survivors here primarily when we're coming at it from an advocacy background, because the idea is that unless someone has been a fatality of domestic violence and is in fact a victim, that they have survived an incident of domestic violence. And it's a nomenclature that we use, but I know that the police officers do tend to use perpetrator and victim. That's the language that they use. So, I mean, either one works out fine, but I just wanted you to know, if I keep saying survivors, I'm not trying to subtly correct you or anything. That's just the language that we use from an advocacy background. We know when someone comes to use our services that the average number of times a survivor will return to their abuser before making before finally going for good is up to 9 times. And the reasons for that are as varied as the reasons for people getting into relationships. It could be an economic reason. Oftentimes abusers will cut off their victims or their survivors, cut off survivors from any sort of access to money or wages or having a job or having resources. It could be children. It could be the fact that they're still very much in love with the abuser. That does happen. So what we do is we try to, if that's the situation, rather than, you know, trying to convince them otherwise, which we don't view as our role, we will work with them to plan how they can do that safely and also how they can prepare if they need to leave again safely. So we very much see our role as being there as a support system for people who need it rather than any sort of, guidance system or, you know, a morality check. You know, we just want to be there to help people get what they need to make them as safe as possible for going forward.
Yeah, in a lot of cases that where this is happening, that a lot of people use children as pawns to manipulate the victim. And you alluded to that fact that, you know, whether it may be the resources, financial, or just whatever the case may be. So what are your thoughts about that in terms of being the children being used as pawns?
I think I was actually speaking with a male survivor who's going to give a talk for us next week about this very situation. He was in a situation where he is still going through a situation that it doesn't just end at the door when you make that choice to leave, especially when there are children involved. Those children are going to be involved for life, and you have a continuing, road to navigate with that. But he and I were talking about that very fact, and that's one of the things that kept him sort of in this relationship for much longer than he would have been in normally, was because he's a big guy. He's a former football player. He's a really interesting guy to listen to and speak on this because it very much was a journey for him of coming through that mindset and going through this situation. And he did have to navigate these waters. And what he had said was that when you have children, you bring in a third party into the relationship, and that is the legal system. So when you have to get out, you not only have your abuser to contend with, but you have the system that now controls and is out of your control, that's kind of got a partial hand in the fate of whatever happens going forward. So it becomes not only a struggle with the person that's been causing the abuse, but it becomes a struggle with the third party.
I hate to cut you off, but we're out of time.
Okay.
It's been a joy speaking with you and informing our public about this very important issue. And so remember that for the audience, that we were talking to Mr. Will Averill, and he's the director of the community engagement. And his telephone number again is, give him your telephone number.
Toll-free number is 1-800-770-3030.
Thank you, Mr. Avery, for being my guest, and go out and have a great day. And you too, Kansas City.
Prison health. In an unhealthy place. It is, at first blush, somewhat odd to expect health care in a place where, essentially, no one really cares about you. Prisons are the slums of the state, for it is, more often than not, an abode of the poor and a dwelling place of the impoverished. Prisons rarely house the wealthy, and to a lesser degree, the same might be said of the healthy. They are a social political construction erected to provide recession-proof jobs to rural, depressed, white communities. These communities, in turn, benefit from the plethora of jobs attracted by prisons, not just in the realm of so-called security, but healthcare as well. It should therefore surprise no one that the health care provided is of substantially lower quality than the poor health care provided to poor communities and in working class neighborhoods. One of the most significant challenges facing both prisoners and free communities is hepatitis C, which causes liver damage and related illnesses. While hep C is actually curable, the cost of antiviral drugs is prohibitive. The going market price for these drugs is about $1,000 a pill, or about $90,000 for a full daily regimen of its, say, 8 to 12 weeks. Who can afford that, free or imprisoned? But health, like any other social good, comes through struggle. There have been legal attacks, yes, protests, and public calls for making these drugs available. Some have prevailed. Others have not. The struggle continues across the country. Thank you for your time. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
One, two, three.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.